The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Freedom Scientific website. There's a webinar on the 15th of this month about Microsoft Word styles that you can use with JAWS. From the Atlantic magazine, there's an opinion on the negatives of lower-cost insulin. From the Wall Street Journal, there's an article about can eye transplants become a thing? From Disability Rights NC, there's an article on blind patients getting a settlement from the UNC Health that I missed back in July. From Cool Blind Tech, Google Meet has introduced some new features. So let's get started. You can register for Freedom Scientific's webinar at us06web.zoom.us. Webinar registration. Prep and proof. Use styles in Microsoft Word with JAWS. Want to learn how to format documents more efficiently with JAWS? Join us on Thursday, September 15th for a live webinar, Prep and Proof. Use styles in Microsoft Word with JAWS. Objectives. We'll provide an overview of what styles are and how to use them, plus show you how to apply existing Word styles to a document, create new styles to customize formatting, create a table of contents using styles. Freedom Scientific presenters are Elizabeth Whitaker, Kathy Johnson, and Rachel Buchanan. ACV REP credits will be available for those who attend the live webinar. Help us spread the word. Please feel free to share this invitation with someone you think might benefit from attending. From theatlantic.com, lowering the cost of insulin could be deadly. If the drug becomes significantly cheaper than newer, better diabetes treatments, more people could die from the disease. Article by Michael Rose on September 5th. If the drug becomes significantly cheaper than newer, better diabetes treatments, more people could die from the disease. When I heard that my patient was back in the ICU, my heart sank. But I wasn't surprised. Her paycheck usually runs short at the end of the month, so her insulin does too. As she stretches her supply, her blood sugar climbs. Soon the insatiable thirst and constant urination follow, and once her keto acids build up, her stomach pains and vomiting start. She always manages to make it to the hospital before the damage reaches her brain and heart, but we both worry that someday she won't. The Inflation Reduction Act passed last month aims to help people like her by lowering the cost of insulin across America. Although efforts to expand protections to privately insured Americans were blocked in the Senate, Democrats succeeded in capping expenses for the drug among Americans on Medicare at $35 a month, offering meaningful savings for our seniors, some of whom will save hundreds of dollars a month thanks to the measure. In theory, the policy and similar ones at state level will help the estimated 25% of Americans on insulin who have been forced to ration the drug because of cost, and will prevent some of the 600 annual American deaths from diabetic ketoacidosis, the fate from which I'm trying to save my patient. Indeed, laws capping co-payments for insulin are welcome news, both financially and medically, to patients who depend on the drug for survival. However, in their current version, such laws might backfire, leading to even more diabetes-related deaths overall. How could that be true? Thanks to the development of new drugs, insulin's role in diabetes treatment has been declining over the past decade. It remains essential to a small percent of patients with type 1 diabetes, including my patient. But for the 90% of Americans with diabetes who have type 2, it should not routinely be the first, second, or even third line treatment. The reasons for this are many. Of all diabetes medications, insulin carries the highest risk of causing dangerously low blood sugar. The medication most commonly comes in injectable form, so administering it usually means painful needle jabs. All of this effort is rewarded with usually unwanted weight gain. Foremost and finally, although insulin is excellent at tamping down high blood sugar, the hallmark of diabetes and the driver of some of its complications, it is not as impressive as other medications at mitigating the most deadly and debilitating consequences of the disease, heart attacks, kidney disease, and heart failure. Large clinical trials have shown that two newer classes of diabetes medicines, SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists, outperform alternatives, including insulin, in reducing the risk of those disabling or deadly outcomes. Giving patients these drugs instead of older options over a period of 3 years prevents, on average, one death for almost every 100 treated. And SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists pose less risk of causing dangerously low blood sugar, generally do not require frequent injections, and help patients lose weight. Based on these data, the American Diabetes Association now recommends SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists be used before insulin for most patients with type 2 diabetes. When a young person dies from diabetic ketoacidosis because they rationed insulin, the culprit is clear. But when a patient with diabetes dies of a heart attack, the absence of an SGLT2 inhibitor or GLP-1 receptor agonist doesn't get blamed because other explanations abound. Their uncontrolled blood pressure, the cholesterol medication they didn't take, the cigarettes they continued to smoke, bad genes, bad luck. But every year, more than 1,000 times more Americans die of heart disease than DKA. And of those 700,000 deaths, a good chunk are diabetes-related. The exact number remains murky. Diabetes is a major reason that more than 500,000 Americans depend on dialysis to manage their end-stage kidney disease, and that about 6 million live with congestive heart failure. The data are clear. SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists could help reduce these numbers. Still, uptake of these life-saving drugs is sluggish. Only about 1 in 10 people with type 2 diabetes is taking them, fewer still among patients who are not wealthy or white. The main cause is simple and stupid. American laws prioritize profits and patents over patients. Because SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists remain under patent protections, drug companies can charge exorbitant rates for them, hundreds if not thousands of dollars a month, sometimes even more than insulin. Doctors spend hours completing arduous paperwork in the hopes of persuading insurers to help our patients, but we are frequently denied anyway. And even when we do succeed, many patients are left with painful co-payments and deductibles. The most maddening part is that despite their substantial upfront expense, these medications are quite cost-effective in the long run because they prevent pricey complications down the road. This is where addressing the cost of insulin and only insulin becomes problematic. Doctors are forced daily to decide between the best medication for our patients and the medication that our patients can afford. Katie Shaw, a primary care physician with a bustling practice at Johns Hopkins, where I'm a senior resident, told me that plenty of her patients can't afford SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists. In such instances, Shaw is forced to use older oral alternatives and occasionally insulin. They're better than nothing at all, she said. If the cost of insulin is capped on its own, insulin will more likely to jump in front of SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists in treatment plans. That will mean more disease, more disability, and more death from diabetes. Medicare patients might avoid some of these effects thanks to provisions in the IRA allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices and capping out-of-pocket spending on prescriptions at $2,000 a year. The law also guarantees price negotiations for a handful of medications, but SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists won't necessarily be on the list, and most Americans are not on Medicare. Already, Shaw said, the patients in her practice who tend to be least able to afford SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists are working-class people with private insurance. Some health centers, including the one Shaw and I work at, enjoy access to a federal drug discount program that can make patent-protected medications, including those two categories, more affordable for the uninsured. But most Americans without insurance aren't so lucky. It would be cruel to choose between a world in which more people with type 2 diabetes are nudged toward a drug that won't stave off the most dangerous complications, and one in which those with type 1 diabetes are priced out of life. In place of capping the out-of-pocket cost of just insulin, lawmakers should cap the out-of-pocket cost of all diabetes medications. This will both protect Americans dependent on insulin and smooth SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists' path to their revolutionary public health potential. The argument for lowering the cost of these drugs for patients is the same as the argument for insulin affordability, that it is both foolish and inhumane to make life-saving diabetes medications unaffordable when their use prevents costly and deadly downstream complications. Patients like mine need affordable access to insulin, but even more need access to SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists. If the laws stop at insulin, many Americans could die unnecessarily, not from inadequate access to insulin, but from preferential access to it. From the Wall Street Journal, September 4th, a spark of life after death points to new hope for blindness. Researchers are restoring function to the eyes of organ donors, providing a new path for studying eye diseases to help restore lost sight, by Ron Winslow, W-I-N-S-L-O-W. The accomplishment, which many experts hadn't thought possible, gives scientists the ability for the first time to conduct experiments on a functioning human retina, potentially unlocking a treasure trove of new information about the chemistry of vision and what goes wrong in the intricate network of retinal cells when people start losing their sight. If you don't understand what the fundamental basics of these normal abnormalities is, you won't be able to identify drugs or other treatments that could treat these conditions, said Anne Hanneken, H-A-N-N-E-K-E-N, Associate Professor of Molecular Medicine at Scripps Research Institute, La Jolla, California, and co-leader of the effort. The achievement also may help advance prospects for eye transplants, though Dr. Hanneken cautioned that such potential treatments are many years away. Doctors for decades have been able to transplant corneas from donor eyes, but that outer layer of the eye that helps with focus doesn't have a blood supply and isn't directly connected to retinal neurons that send sight signals to the brain. Getting transplanted eyes or retinal tissue to communicate with the brain is a daunting challenge. Ambitious research is underway across the field of ophthalmology to find new ways to prevent, slow, or treat vision loss. Strategies range from developing drugs that protect people with vision loss against further damage to restoring vision with cell and gene therapies that would replace, regenerate, or repair retinal neurons that no longer work. The first approval for any gene therapy came in 2018 for a mutation that causes blindness. Anne Hanneken, Associate Professor, is co-leader of the effort to bring eyes from Anne Hanneken, Associate Professor of Molecular Medicine at Scripps Research Institute, is co-leader of the effort to bring eyes from organ donors back to life, photo by Stephanie Sundell. More than 7 million Americans of all ages are living with loss of visual acuity, according to a study published last year in JAMA Ophthalmology, of whom more than 1 million are blind. The toll is growing, partly reflecting an aging population and a high prevalence of diabetes, a precursor to such diseases as glaucoma and diabetic retinopathy. Worldwide, more than 250 million people have vision loss, while another 43 million are blind. Sight begins when light passes through the cornea and lens and hits neurons called photoreceptors that live in the retina and the back of the eye. It takes a seamless network of other retinal cells, each with its distinct roles, to process the light signals and transmit them via the optic nerve to the brain, which converts the data into the clear, focused color images some see. Eye diseases such as glaucoma, age-related macular degeneration, and the inherited retinitis pigmentosa exact a toll on vision by damaging or killing various retinal cells. A class of drugs including Regeneron Inc.'s Eylea and Roche Holding AG's Lucentis can be injected into the eye to treat wet age-related macular degeneration, the most advanced and debilitating form of AMD, and the leading cause of reading loss and irreversible blindness in the elderly. The disease damages a layer of neurons called the retinal pigment epithelium, which is crucial to the survival of the photoreceptors. The injections stanch the growth of abnormal, leaky blood vessels that grow under the macular region of the retina, which is responsible for clear central vision. But the drugs don't affect dry AMD, the more common and earlier stage of AMD, and may be less effective against a host of genetic alterations that each represent a different variant of the disease. We whack everything with the same hammer, said Julia Haller, H-A-L-L-E-R, ophthalmologist-in-chief at Wills Eye Hospital, Philadelphia. A more sophisticated understanding that would potentially lead to more drug targets and more personal approaches would be fantastic. So would, say, more insight into early stages of macular degeneration where treatments are needed to protect against worsening disease. You could imagine doing experiments in organ donor tissue from people who had early macular degeneration, said Joan Miller, chief of ophthalmology at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. It might help you to tease out what are some of the early steps in the condition. Researchers for decades have relied heavily on mouse studies to help understand the basis of human eye diseases, but mice don't see in color. They don't even have a macula, and they don't get macular degeneration, said Dr. Hanekin, who is also a retinal surgeon at Scripps Memorial Hospital, La Jolla. You want a model that mimics the human disease. That was the motivation behind Dr. Hanekin's 6-year quest to bring dead eyes back to life. It drew skeptics. Trying to revive dead nerve cells challenged a basic belief that the death of neurons is irreversible. But her research with eyes obtained after autopsy convinced Dr. Hanekin that some metabolic activity persisted, at least briefly, after death. Experiments with both mice and human postmortem eyes showed that loss of oxygen and changes in acidity were the main culprits in the rapid demise of retinal cells. She began a collaboration with Franz Binberg, a neuroscientist at University of Utah who built a container akin to the coolers transplant surgeons use to transport organs recovered from donors. The container is equipped with tiny tanks, which the researchers usually fill at scuba dive shops, to provide oxygen to donor eyes. The eyes are also bathed in a cocktail of nutrients designed to normalize acidity and wake up the retinal cells and restore their function. For some 2 years, the researchers obtained donated eyes from several sources and carried them in the container to their lab for testing. Apart from an occasional small electrical signal, they got nothing. The problem, they concluded, too much time had elapsed between the death of the donor and the removal of the eyes. Then an organ donor organization agreed to allow Dr. Hanekin to recover eyes from patients who were declared brain dead, but who remained on life support, to keep their heart and other organs viable for transplant. That changed everything, she said. In eyes recovered within 30 to 60 minutes after life support was removed, the researchers were able to detect the entire light signaling cascade through the macular region of the retina, from the photoreceptors that first absorb the light to the neurons that send the signals to the brain. While doctors can measure such signals to diagnose sight loss in patients, the new research now enables experiments and drug tests on the donor eyes that wouldn't be possible on living people. Details of the effort were published in the journal Nature in May. The researchers couldn't prove that the revived eyes could actually see. The eyes can respond to light, but they can't read the headlines of the Wall Street Journal, Dr. Hanekin said. They're not connected to a brain. So far, revived eyes have remained viable for research for up to 24 hours, she said. Efforts to analyze the data stream from the light signals have already revealed promise for learning about molecular abnormalities associated with various retinal diseases and devising ways to treat them, she said. Indeed, having access to revived human retinal tissue marks an advance that will help us better understand how these cells work and influence that response with drugs or changes in gene expression to allow them to function better, said Akrit Sodhi, that's A-K-R-I-T-S-O-D-H-I, an ophthalmologist and researcher at Johns Hopkins Medicine, Baltimore, who wasn't involved in the research. Dr. Hanekin believes the research has implications beyond ophthalmology. If retinal neurons can be brought back to life, what about central nervous system cells associated with other diseases? She has already begun discussions with scientists who are looking for ways to overcome damage to neurons associated with stroke and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases. Write to the future of everything at future@wsj.com. More stories from the Wall Street Journal's The Future of Everything about how innovation and technology are transforming the way we live, work, and play are available at the hot link, The Future of Everything. Now the article from disabilityrightsnc.org that I missed back in July. Blind patients receive settlement from UNC Healthcare System. Raleigh, North Carolina. UNC Healthcare System, UNC Health, will pay $125,000 in damages and admit to violating federal disability rights laws to settle legal claims by blind patients that UNC Health does not provide written materials in Braille, large print, or accessible formats. Timothy Miles, John Bone, the National Federation of the Blind and Disability Rights NC, alleged that UNC Healthcare System systematically discriminates against blind people by failing to provide them written information in formats they can access, such as large print, Braille, and accessible electronic formats, that enable them to participate fully in their care and make timely payments on their medical bills. Timothy Miles, a longtime patient of UNC Health, repeatedly asked for large print formats of patient history forms, after-visit summaries, billing information, and other written communications from UNC Health, but continued to receive them in standard print. After John Bone received emergency medical care at Nash General Hospital, an affiliate of UNC Health, he received bills and other communications about his care in standard print. Mr. Bone repeatedly asked to be provided the information in Braille, but did not receive it in a timely manner. The settlement follows a magistrate judge recommendation that UNC Health be held liable for violating the federal disability rights laws for its failures to ensure equally effective communication with blind patients. Following the settlement, litigation will continue to determine the policy changes UNC Health will be required to implement to ensure future compliance with federal disability rights laws, requiring healthcare providers like UNC Health to communicate as effectively with blind patients as it does with patients without disabilities. With today's technology, providing bills, medical records, and treatment instructions in alternative formats, such as Braille and large print, is readily achievable, said Mark Riccobono, president of the National Federation of the Blind. We believe this settlement sends a strong message that medical providers must take this legal and moral obligation seriously. The National Federation of the Blind, relying on the extensive expertise and lived experiences of our members, as well as our decades of work on these issues, is happy to collaborate with healthcare entities who want guidance in providing medical information in accessible formats. Navigating the healthcare system is already challenging. Denying blind patients equal access to information about their own healthcare by failing to put the information in formats accessible to them not only violates the law, it impermissibly endangers their health, said Virginia Knowlton Marcus, Chief Executive Officer of Disability Rights NC. We are thankful for strong advocates such as Mr. Miles and Mr. Bone, who are willing to challenge the status quo and stand up for their right and the right of all blind patients in North Carolina to be equal participants in their health care. The plaintiffs are represented by the attorneys of Disability Rights NC and the Baltimore law firm of Brown, Goldstein, and Levy. About the National Federation of the Blind. The National Federation of the Blind, NFB, headquartered in Baltimore, defends the rights of blind people of all ages and provides information and support to families with blind children, older Americans who are losing vision, and more. Founded in 1940, the NFB is the transformative membership and advocacy organization of blind Americans with affiliates, chapters, and divisions in the 50 states, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico. We believe in the hopes and dreams of blind people and work together to transform them into reality. Learn more about our many programs and initiatives at nfb.org. About Disability Rights North Carolina. Disability Rights North Carolina is the federally mandated protection and advocacy system in North Carolina, dedicated to advancing the rights of all people with disabilities of all ages, statewide. DRNC is an independent 501c3 nonprofit organization and a member of the National Disability Rights Network. Learn more about Disability Rights North Carolina at disabilityrightsnc.org. There is a list of contacts with their phone numbers. Chris Danielson, that's with an EN, Director of Public Relations, National Federation of the Blind, 410-659-9314, extension 2330. And his cell number is 410-262-1281. You can email him at cdanielson@nfb.org. Holly Stiles, litigation counsel, Disability Rights North Carolina. Her number is 919-856-2195. Email her at holly.styles@disabilitierightsnc.org. From coolblindtech.com, Google Meet launches new accessibility features, posted September 2nd. Google Meet users will soon find that their space button will now double as a mute toggle in Google Meet's latest update. Google announced through their own blog that Google Meet would receive a new suite of updates now that the popular video conferencing service has hit web devices. How useful will this feature be for users? This will be useful for users who join video calls with the mute on by default, and those who regularly forget to mute their microphones after they're done speaking. Are the new features on by default? You will need to be sure that you turn these on in their settings to enable the toggles. What are some of the other features? This update also comes with other accessibility features. Accessible info requires a screen reader. Announce who is currently speaking. Mac, Control, the flower button, and S. On PC, Control plus the Alt button plus S. Announce the current information about the room. Mac, Control plus flower plus I. PC, Control plus Alt plus I. Meeting controls. Show or hide captions. Mac, the letter C. PC, the letter C. Turn on or off camera. Mac, Control, flower plus E. PC, Control plus E. Mute or unmute your microphone. Mac, flower plus D. PC, Control plus D. Increase the number of participant tiles. Mac, Control plus flower plus K. PC, Control plus Alt plus K. Decrease the number of participant tiles. Mac, Control plus flower plus J. PC, Control plus Alt plus J. Show or hide meeting chat window. Mac, Control plus flower plus C. PC, Control plus Alt plus C. Show or hide participants. Mac, Control plus flower plus P. PC, Control plus Alt plus P. Raise or lower your hand. Control plus flower plus H on a Mac. Control plus Alt plus H on a PC. Minimize or expand your video. Mac, Control plus flower plus M. PC, Control plus Alt plus M. When is the update expected to roll out? The update should be dropping on September 7th, but it could take up to 2 weeks for the rollout to be universal across platforms. Hopefully, these shortcuts will prove helpful to all Google Meet users across the web. Also posted on September 2nd was a list of ways to change Alexa's name and wake word on your devices. You can change your wake word directly on your Echo device using voice commands. Say, Alexa, change your wake word. Alexa will say, okay. You can choose from Amazon, Computer, Echo, or Ziggy. Which of these do you like? Say whichever word you want. Alexa will say, okay, you can call me that word on this device in a few seconds. There is more at the rest of it, but I'm out of time for this week's episode of Vision News. I hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next week. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.